Notenköpfe. Da ist Musik im Gespräch. Ein Rondo-Podcast. Heute für euch da, Chris Lloyd.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to the Notenköpfe podcast, live from the Classical Next Conference in Berlin. Today, we're going to be deep diving into one of my favorite topics, the recording industry. Classical Next is the world's leading classical music innovation conference, with over 1,600 delegates from around the world visiting Berlin to discuss all manner of topics around the industry at large. We have conservatoires, orchestras, tech startups, independent organizations, international country representatives, managers, festival organizers, booking agents. The list is endless, and I'm absolutely chuffed to be joined in this discussion by one of the top representatives of the recording industry. Before I introduce her, I'd like to give a bit of background information on the evolution of the recording industry and some of the issues it has encountered over the years. How often do you, as a listener, think about the world behind the records you listen to? It all started in the late 19th century when Thomas Edison released his first tinfoil recording device. Whilst many in recent years have pointed at the emergence of streaming on platforms like Spotify as a huge turning point, I would argue that the development of recording in the first place was probably the single largest technological explosion in music since our prehistoric ancestors first started keeping time with rhythm sticks. Think about it. Before a recording was possible, music was a purely ephemeral experience. One had to be in the presence of someone making it in order to experience it. All of a sudden, what was fleeting became eternal. Edison's invention turned people's relationship with music completely upside down. It's no coincidence that the height of piano literacy in Europe coincides roughly with the development of recording. And whilst the once common household skill of piano playing has become the preserves of a relatively small few, recordings proliferate across almost every facet of our lives. A key issue faced by the recording industry, as it is with much of the classical music industry as a whole, is the case of relevance. Since inception, the goal of recording engineers was to capture the most lifelike sound possible. As one executive stated, they wanted their records to give the impression of sitting in the best seat in the house. For decades, Decca, Deutsche Grammophon, Philips, and EMI were in a space race, developing new technology to achieve this goal. Tape editing became popular in the middle of the 20th century, allowing producers and performers to attain a level of perfection that was only previously dreamed of. Artists such as Glenn Gould, Pierre Schaeffer, and the Beatles saw the new possibilities of the recording as a standalone art form, and many classical musicians and organizations began to view the achievements of recording an entire Beethoven or Mahler cycle as the gold standard of achievement. The late 1980s saw a new technological development, the compact disc, which briefly boosted sales in classical music as diehard aficionados replaced their LP collections with the superior sounding format. However, only two decades later, a new, more insidious encroacher in the form of streaming platforms began to threaten the all-too-delicate ecosystem that is the classical music recording industry. There are now three major labels left in the world: Universal Music Group, Sony Music Entertainment, and Warner Music Group, under which many of the labels we know and love operate. The final quarter of the industry is taken up by smaller independent labels, all with their own challenges and struggles, as they seek to gain new listeners and buyers in a tech-dominated digital world that seems to have all but forgotten classical music. With me to discuss this world and how they are navigating the challenges of the 21st century is Cleopatra Sofroniou, the General Manager of Classics at Deutsche Grammophon and, I believe, a former writer for Rondo magazine. Welcome, Cleopatra. It's an absolute thrill to have you alongside for this discussion as we delve into your world that few may have thought about, but one that affects our daily lives. It's a real treat to have you on this podcast, as I'm sure most of our listeners would be regular listeners to the albums you release, but wouldn't often have the opportunity to learn more about what happens behind the scenes of the music they all enjoy. Would you mind telling us a bit about yourself? How did you end up in the classical recording industry? I noted whilst researching your work history that before starting with Universal Music and Deutsche Grammophon, you had a stint at Amazon Germany. Did music play a big role in your life growing up, or did you come to it later in adulthood?
Hi, thanks for having me. Good to be here. Wow, what a great summary of the recording history you've given us today, and thank you for introducing me. Well, where do I start, actually? I was born and raised in Greece. I went to school there. And actually, when I reflect the beginning of my time as a thinking person, I wanted to become a philosopher. That was my first wish of occupation, which you can imagine, it was very romantic. My relationship to music was always also very romantic. My father was a choir singer, amateur, but a very great voice. So he was engaging with a lot of choirs, and he even managed to get some great awards with some of his choirs in old music, classical old music, so to say, because in Greece, we don't have that much of a classical music tradition. We listen much more Greek music, and in our churches, we don't listen to Bach. We listen to Byzantine or Greek Orthodox music. So in a sense, music was always a part of my life, but not the music I'm working at and with at the moment. Another music, the traditional Greek music, the Orthodox church music, the songs of Mikis Theodorakis that people might know, that my father used to sing with his out-of-tune guitar many times. And when I was 10, I thought, I want to learn the piano. We didn't have a piano. We didn't have a piano at home. So I had to spare all the money from my birthdays and holiday gifts and you know, all the little things that the numerous aunts and uncles are giving you for Christmas. And my parents were generous to me, so they bought a piano for me so that I can learn the piano. So next to philosopher, I also wanted to become a pianist. At the end of the day, nothing of these plans materialized. I become a manager.
And one of those first roles was not even in the music industry, but if I remember correctly, you studied in Germany. So you came from Greece to study in Germany. And how did you end up getting into management from a starting point of philosophy and music?
That's a miracle. I finished my studies in Greece, so I did manage to get the degree in philosophy and piano in Greece. I came to Stuttgart for some more studies in music. And then I thought that actually I'm not good enough to become a professional musician, but I have a way with words sometimes. So I thought, why don't I stay a little bit longer, learn a little bit more German, try to find a profession that covers philosophy, Greek tradition, music and piano. And I landed doing some studies in journalism. And from that point, it was clear that I would become a part of an industry or of a crowd of people that are thinking and talking about music and communicating and facilitating musicians rather than doing music ourselves. From that part, going into a record label, it was not that far away, to be honest.
The classical music recording industry is a notoriously difficult one to navigate. Simply put, the effort, time, money, and expertise required to record a symphony orchestra is extreme, whilst the audience remains relatively niche in comparison, at least, to the pop music industry. Can you shed some light on how it all works? I remember once a quote from a record label executive who explained how the profit from every Beatles album allowed them to record another 10 bands. Is it the same for Deutsche Grammophon, where certain artists who sell a lot facilitate the more perhaps experimental or artistic endeavors of others?
There is a term we use which is called mixed calculation. So we always try to find very commercial projects that are very profitable. And these projects, they really help us support forms of art and expression and that are not securely commercial from the beginning. The same applies with established artists and developing artists, by the way. Having established artists that can guarantee you a volume of streams or sales, it's really very important because then we can go and risk investing in some new professionals. We can invest in new artists.
And so that sort of, I imagine, it has this continual ecosystem of the circle of life continues to go, which is a beautiful concept.
This is the beauty of the record industry, is exactly that. While in the live industry, every concert needs to have its own breakdown calculation, or a tour needs to be profitable. And it's only the one tour that counts for profits and losses. In the record industry, we have successful projects from the last year that can help us finance the projects of this year. This is the huge power of the catalog. It's very important to know that a successful catalog is a security. It's a perpetual income that helps you create new projects.
When you have a catalog as long and is it respectable or as held in high regard, you're essentially in charge of this, like the Vatican's bankers almost, of the one of the most wonderful catalogs in history recorded. Do you feel you have a specific role as a purveyor or as a looking after this catalog essentially, and what you add to it is a part of this huge legacy?
Actually, my first job at Universal Music Deutsche Grammophon was product manager catalog. So I came from a very commercial place at Amazon Music to start working in the archives. And I did it with great joy because this was the time I learned the most about music, because I had to listen to many different recordings, compare them, find the ones that are commercial, but also find the ones that are interesting to rediscover, because this is actually the job of a catalog manager, is to always go back to the archives and try to find either old, forgotten recordings that need to be refreshed and represented, or get the old ones that are still very valid and very well known and represented in a way that applies to younger generations that might not even have ever the chance to meet the artist or see them, feel them, and see them in concerts. To give you an example, one of the first projects I was working at for Universal Music when I started was do a Mozart catalog, because the Mozart year 2005, and I was responsible in bringing all the remarkable recordings of Mozart, whatever genre, of Deutsche Grammophon in one place. That was a huge fun and also a huge responsibility. And it was a very good place to start for someone that wants to work in a recording industry. I learned a lot.
It reminds me of a quote I read from Daniel Barenboim in a book called Play It Again. And he was explaining how, it's off the top of my head now, but essentially he was saying how difficult it is for a conductor in the 20th and 21st centuries who no longer have to compete just with their peers, but they also have to compete with all the conductors throughout history who have recorded the same pieces. Are you finding that artists are struggling to find a unique voice, their own unique voice, when they're compared to such a long catalogue? Or are you finding they are excited to join that list?
It might sound arrogant or too confident, but I haven't seen our artists struggle with it. The opposite, I think, it's a source of inspiration. And a lot of our artists like to go back, and it's very interesting that they don't all have the same idols. It's very interesting to see that some conductors also like to listen to singers or pianists, and some pianists like to listen to cellists, and they get their own learnings and experiences out of that. And actually, I think this is the moment where you see that someone is an authentic artist, that even if something is there in multiple versions, they still find their own voice.
So, Cleopatra, in your role as the general manager of Classics, well, this role includes a strong element of marketing innovation and partnership development. That is, there's far more to the job than just recording, releasing, and sending the albums out for reviewing. What role does placement, partnerships, and facilitation play in your work? That is, like, what is the type of work that you're doing to actively find new places for classical music to be heard?
That's a very tough question. Actually, the job in marketing is to first listen to what the artist has to say and how the artist see themselves and their career development. After this reflection has taken place, then we need to think how we can help the artist to raise their voices and which are the right partners to go. So it's not per se that we're always looking for the innovation. Sometimes we're looking for the traditional places that have a strong audience and want to connect these audiences with the specific artists. In terms of innovation, I personally like very much to try new things. So I try to try new media outlets, new types of content creation, or new types of specific activities with social media channels or with streaming partners. I can't find a rule that applies to that. It's all doing by doing. But the very important thing is the beginning, the thorough reflection of what is the product, what does the artist want to say with it, and which type of audience might be relevant for this message.
And are you saying that you like trying new things and innovation? How do you find, as a general rule, the artists? Are they open to that, or do they push back, or is it really just up to the individual?
It's up to the individual, and also the type of the idea and how convincing it is. And it's also important to know if some artists like to leave the safe zone, because everything we do as a record label is public space. And some artists are ready to take risks, some others don't.
The landscape of recording is changing at record paces. I recall once a conversation I had with one of your colleagues at Universal Music in around 2016. She told me that CDs would never be irrelevant for Universal Music customers. At the time, I was rather shocked, thinking that CDs were already strongly hurtling towards relevancy with the widespread growth of internet streaming, of course on Spotify, but also then on specialist platforms like Adagio and now Apple Classics. How does Deutsche Grammophon navigate this constant need for evolution? Do you still see CDs and now LPs with their Lazarus-like resurgence as a vital distribution method, or are you strongly focused towards the digital space moving forward?
We try to cover both ways. The streaming is, of course, the new one. And to be honest, if we want to reach to younger generations, we must be focused on streaming. I don't think there are many people under the age of 14 that own a CD player anymore, or even have a stick for downloads in their laptops. So if we want to find the new ones, the new audience, the new lovers of classical music, we have to go with their habits. So there is no way out of streaming, no way at all. On the other side, we see an audience growing that like to possess things, which is also very good for us and very good for the artist. This is the so-called fan and super fan. They are the people that like to go to more multiple concerts. They like to listen to different versions of things. They like to engage with artists. They like to read articles. They might have a subscription in the concert hall. And these people might also listen to streaming. But when they find something they like, they also have to have it in their collection. It doesn't matter if it's a CD or a vinyl. It depends on the type of person you are, how much money you have to afford one or the other method of owning a product. But at the end of the day, it's important to also serve these peoples and their need for having something in their hands that they can keep and they can use forever and ever.
That sounds fantastic. I mean, I imagine that's a sort of 360 approach to releasing. So that one can encounter the album first via a streaming platform and then fall in love with the artist and buy the LP and also then have access to the information on tour dates via the streaming platform. So I think there's a lot of a negativity that surrounds the evolution of streaming. I think particularly musicians, as a general rule, we don't like change, but yeah, the possibilities that are opened up is something we don't think of too often. And I think including the younger generations, there's some data coming out finally that's showing younger generations are engaging more with classical music because of streaming platforms. So the yellow label of Deutsche Grammophon is perhaps the most iconic and recognizable branding in classical music. It's been a staple since 1948. And with it comes the label of prestige, and I dare say tradition, laden with expectation. And what I'm getting at here is that I imagine when it comes to innovating and breaking new boundaries, especially with regards to developing these younger audiences, you would have to draw a fine line between alienating your existing customer base when it comes to releasing new content and also continuing to evolve and develop new sounds and artists. So what is the process that you need to go through with artists when they want to develop a new project, or even when your A&R scouts are out looking for new talent?
In current years, Deutsche Grammophon has decided to structure the A&R and marketing team in different sub-teams with different focus and purposes, because we want to acknowledge that there is a very traditional part of our job, which we still want to aim for and want to do in the best way ever. But also we need to have our eyes open and our ears even more open for new developments. And also there is a need for looking into the so-called crossover space. I think many people hate the word, but it still covers, I think, this description of projects that are between the genres, and they might have a potential to reach people outside the classical aficionado. So what we've done is we have separated the teams in classical, neoclassical, and so-called special projects teams, which looks after all these types of electronic music, crossover music, new composers, music coming from other cultures, for example, animated or the gaming industry and so on and so on. These teams work together, but they're also separated, and every team has its own identity. This is the answer we gave to the need of staying true to ourselves as a traditional classical label, but also looking for new ideas and new audiences. And I've seen it working very well, because every team is independent and every team makes their own decisions.
And that sounds like you've navigated a really complex maze in a really simple way, like a simple and efficient way. How do you marry up with the core classical audience who has their, pointed opinions about what should be classical music and what should not be? Have you experienced any pushback from the established Deutsche Grammophon clientele with regards to these artists that might not fit their idea of what Deutsche Grammophon represents?
Of course, there is always a debate about what is classical music, what belongs to the canon of classical music and what is not. This is not a new debate. It was also in older times. I think every crossover project has been debated and criticized like this. And this is nothing new. Of course, we had people that think that Max Richter is too simplistic, or Hugh Beaving and Roger Eno are not classical musicians. How do we navigate this? We believe in authenticity. If music and musicians are authentic in what they're doing, and we like that, and we like the results, then the debates will not stop us. On the contrary, debates are sometimes useful, because it helps us to understand what could be the worries, what could be the insecurities, and make us rethink and plan better our communication and the message of that comes with projects like those.
It brings me to an interesting thought, which is the sort of the dual role of commercial viability and responsibility to previous buyers, and at the same time being the head of an organization that is essentially in the business of art. So what would you say your overall responsibility is to the art form of classical music, and that includes the tradition and also the new? Because I find this juxtaposition of two worlds fascinating. On the one hand, Deutsche Grammophon, Universal Music, is a commercially viable company that has responsibility to shareholders. And on the other hand, you do play a very key role as a custodian of an ancient art form. So most of what is heard on recording by audiences is a direct result of the decisions made by record label executives. How do you personally balance these two responsibilities?
This is a very hard question. I think as an organization, I see here on people working that all love classical music. There is no one working at Deutsche Grammophon that doesn't have a personal relationship to this art form. Some of us have really studied classical music. Some others have studied musicology or history of music. Some of us have studied production, and some of us are amateurs, but real music lovers. So the personal element of having to do with music we love is key. The second thing about responsibility to the form of art, it has to do with the way of production first. So whatever Deutsche Grammophon is bringing out, we really do our best. And we're talking about lengthy and complicated technical controls about everything. Mistakes happen sometimes, but it's on the human error. And the terms of technical construction and conditions, we always try to do the best, to have the best possible result out to the world. This is a part of the education, a duty of a record company, to bring the best music in the best quality ever. In terms of selection and curation, we try to keep the balance between honing the catalog and then bringing up again and again the iconic recordings of the past in new formats. This is also part of education and the role of a record label. But we also want to find new talents. So we always sign new instrumentalists. We have relationships with some of the most successful and important orchestras and institutions of the world, because we really want to keep nurturing the core classical artists of today. The other part of the job is trying to find the new talents or follow trends of that are outside the core classical scope. It's also part of the job, because music evolves, and with it people, or people evolve and music with them. The one way or the other, we think we have to be very close to these developments. Sometimes we might make mistakes. We might sign the wrong artist, or we might assign the wrong product. But I think personally that in the whole of thousands of recordings that a label that Deutsche Grammophon is keeping alive, some mistakes, let's say one mistake a year or two, should be allowed. I personally would like to focus on the products and the recordings that have touched my heart and also have touched the hearts of many people and the audience around us, and try to focus on these and on the artists that have created them, to multiply the importance and the impact of the art.
For the listener who is thinking for the first time, how does this artwork get into my computer or onto my vinyl player? What is the process of creating a new work with artists and sort of highlighting the first half of the art? So from the conception point, the artist comes to you and says, Cleopatra, I have this great concept. I'm going to record this and it's going to be fantastic, and no one's ever done it before the way I want to do it. So how does it get from that point to the finished product? And how closely are you working, or does your team work with the artists in that scenario?
I tell you one thing that I tell also to every artist that come to us with ambitious ideas. It takes a village for a success, and it takes at least 1 year. So from the moment that an artist has articulated an idea, and we have agreed to this, because also we sometimes debate ideas and try to challenge the artist, or the artist challenges us in a good way. So it's very fun, this process of debating ideas. So from the moment an idea has been decided and is on the way to become a project, it takes at least 12 months, because you need to find the time and the occasion for a recording. Let's say the recording is done, then first edit, second edit, third edit, approval, mastering process takes also a time. In the meanwhile, the marketing and production team start thinking about visualization. It's another nice debate with artists. Are we going with a red dress, or are we going with a green dress? Are we going in the woods, or we're going in the, or are we going on the sea? All these questions have to be raised in the very beginning. And they are not simple questions. It's not like someone wakes up in the morning and says, let's do a photo shoot like this. It takes a lot of effort to combine the mood of the music with the story that the artist wants to say, and also with personal preferences and the things that also labels want to achieve with a recording. So all that takes 6 months at least. And then, and the rest of the 6 months is preparation for communication, for social media, for finalizing all the concepts and going to the markets.
And what happens if an artist is sort of exceptionally driven to do something that really just doesn't work? I'm sure that happens on a regular basis. Have you ever been proven wrong in that you said no and it happened anyway somehow, and you're like, I was absolutely wrong? Or and if, on the other hand, when it really is just the worst concept that could be imagined, how do you go about letting them down easily?
There's many stories and anecdotes on these things. Of course I have misjudged projects, and I've declared failures to successes and successes to failures sometimes, many times. But the same happens to artists too. We are humans, we make plans, but we don't have scientific proofs. That's why we're debating a lot, because we try to use data analysis, but also we ask ourselves and our hearts and our instincts. We ask the markets. We ask journalists and other producers. So every project is, every decision is, goes through all these steps of questioning and communication. We still sometimes make wrong decisions, as I said before, but many, many times we do the right decisions. What happens if we fail, if that's the next question? Actually, not much. We have a culture of fail fast at Deutsche Grammophon. No one is going to be blamed, really. The things that are to be blamed are if you are not protective enough with artist properties. So legal things. These are rather more relevant, or not keeping the budget. So all the financial, the things that have a material consequences. Making wrong decisions about the project is, of course, not good, but no one is to be blamed, because no one really has a proof of the right concept. The same with the artists. Sometimes artists also make wrong decisions. We never go back to artists and say, you. That doesn't happen. We try to learn from the mistakes and be better the next time.
Now, I've heard the way you talk about artists. Before we started recording, we were having a conversation about how you, and I'll read your title again, is General Manager of Classics at Deutsche Grammophon. There's no higher roles, or there's not many higher roles, I dare say, in the hierarchy. However, you're also still making the effort to go out and see a concert, not even in the same city. You'll go to another city to see one of your artists perform. And the idea of the artist belonging to a sort of larger part of a family here at Deutsche Grammophon is really a beautiful concept that I think people might not sort of recognize. So tell us more about this aspect of your work.
In my role, well, I just happened to be many years in this company, and I've seen many things. I have many experience, gathered experiences from a lot of projects, and now in this role, the biggest thing is I am prioritizing adventures and projects, and I am making sure that every project has resources, money-wise, or also people to work them. And sometimes I have to make hard decisions, like prioritizing the one over the other. And these decisions are in the end of evaluation processes. So it's a complex thing. I can't describe it. In any case, it's not like I like you better than you. It doesn't work like that. In terms of relationship with the artist, you're right. And thank you for raising it. Actually, DG is a little bit of a family, and we all like our artists, especially the exclusive artists, our artists we know many years, and we get to know them also as individuals, not just as artists or, say, clients. And we spend time with them because we want to understand better what are their instincts and what they want to achieve. My ambition is to know all the artists and to visit at least one concert of all of our artists at least once a year. Some of the artists I'm working closer with, some of the artists are in other hands, better hands, more suitable for the purposes of our collaboration. But I know them all, and I spend time with my team and all of these artists.
That's a huge endeavor. That's really impressive to know all of the artists. That's wonderful. What about the other initiatives that Deutsche Grammophon has made recently? Do you believe highly specialized streaming platforms, for instance, are going to be the way forward? I suppose I'm thinking tech initiatives and also marketing initiatives. Or do you believe, as we were talking earlier, it's really not one distribution method, but a combination of all the available options, including hard copy printing, existing platforms, and so on? What do you see as the way forward of the medium of listening that needs to be developed?
Well, I cannot give you an answer to what the medium of the future is going to be. At the moment, I see that we have multiple choices. And these multiple choices are all valid. Huge streaming partners that are doing everything for free, for example, like free tier channels, up to very specialized, high fidelity partners, little shops, bigger shops, bookstores that are selling CDs, or specialized tech shops that are selling super expensive vinyls, customized productions. Everything has its own audience. We shouldn't forget that we are now in a very global industry. It's not localized markets anymore. There is an audience for everything, and we try to keep pace with all of that.
Beautiful. And to finish off with then, finally, what are your personal goals and dreams that you'd like to achieve in the next 30, 40 years? How do you see the future of yourself within Deutsche Grammophon? How do you see the future of the music you want to be part of bringing out to the world? All of these lovely big questions.
The lovely big questions is, of course, we want to keep classical music alive and successful and be even more successful, reach to more people and give them the opportunity to listen to music. There are still many places in the world that don't have access to live concerts. And we think that being able to stream music in audio form, also audio visually, that's the part of the initiative called Stage Plus. It's a nice alternative. It's a good alternative for many people. Let's not forget that some of the biggest artists come from very small places where they didn't have a Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra on their garden. They come from mountain regions or from little islands. And these people are still talents that managed to get into the classical scene. That's the one ambition. So we are very much into try to make music technologically accessible to everyone, everywhere, in the best possible technological format. We want to develop classical music in places of the world where classical music was not relevant before or not that relevant. For example, Asia, South America, and also Africa. That's also an important project. And the third thing is we rediscover the power of new music and want to work with composers and more. And we keep signing composers, not only performers. We've seen that there are new generations of composers. I would like to name, for example, Yunike Tanzil, a very young Indonesian composer that writes for classical orchestras, that are very interesting and new voices, and we want to help these voices to get expanded and have their own recordings.
I said that was the final question, but as you were talking, another question came to me, which is, do you have a balance in your thinking when you're coming up with new projects? For instance, with the push now for female composers to be recognized from not just contemporary but also historical, do you have as a part of your calculations ever the potential for social good for say righting a wrong of a forgotten composer versus a commercial reality that might not be very feasible? Like, how does that sort of play this social responsibility within your work?
This is a really hard question because social responsibility is very valid and very important, and we really think about it a lot, and sometimes we manage to include thoughts like those in project planning. For example, when Lang Lang did his Saint-Saëns album last year, and it was a Saint-Saëns album, he's a male composer, but we thought, okay, there's beautiful music written by a women composer of the same era. Why don't we record more tracks for solo piano? And then we had a lot of single tracks put out and streaming from by female composers. This is just an aspect that shows that we try to do things like that. On the other side, we are dedicated to excellency. I don't think we will sign artists for the sake of representing a minority. We will sign artists regardless of if they're minorities or majorities. We will sign them because we believe in their artistic vision and their excellency. And this is where the end of social responsibility comes to, because at the end, it's about art.
That's a great response to a very difficult question. The very final question officially now is, what is the one recording you want to see made before you finish in the industry? And there's no limitations on that. What would it be?
You make me cry with this question because I don't have an answer. I like them all. All the projects I've been personally involved, there is no one I would say I wouldn't do it. So looking to the future, what I would like to do, no, I won't tell you I want to do all the Beethoven complete edition. No, it's not the type of projects I'm into. I would like to see a new composer rising that gives our beloved classical music maybe a little bit of a new trend, a new idea. That would be fantastic.
Really? Well, thank you so much, Cleopatra Sofroniou, for your time and your expertise and for sharing all these wonderful stories. And I look forward to hearing all the next records that come out and hearing that composer rising and changing our perspective for the way forward. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Notenköpfe ist ein Podcast von Rondo, dem Klassik- und Jazz-Magazin. Informationen zum Magazin und weitere spannende Themen aus der Welt von Klassik und Jazz gibt es auf rondomagazin.de. Redaktion und Moderation Chris Lloyd. Ausführende Produzentin Verena von der Goltz. Aufnahme und Postproduktion Robert Niemeyer. Musik Markus Zierhofer.
Hallo zusammen, ich bin Ineas Hum, Opern- und Konzertsänger, habe an der Juilliard School studiert und singe seither an vielen Bühnen und treffe immer wieder auf geniale Menschen. Aber Kaffee alleine trinken, das macht doch keinen Spaß. Deshalb lade ich ab jetzt regelmäßig spannende Gäste zu mir ein in meinem Podcast Classic Doppio. Wir sprechen über Musik, das Leben, das Scheitern und alles, was dazwischen liegt. Ich freue mich, wenn ihr dabei seid. Auf viele gemeinsame Tassen und Gespräche. Euer Eneas.